Wilson, as he's described in a new graphic novel, is a big-hearted slob, a lonesome bachelor, a devoted father and husband, an idiot, a sociopath, a delusional blowhard, a delicate flower, 100% Wilson-esque. He's the title character of a graphic novelist Daniel Clough's new work. He brought us Ghost World, David Boring, and 8-Ball Comics, among others. And Wilson has received glowing reviews from, among others, the New York Times and the Washington Post. If you'd like to talk with the author about Wilson or about the graphic novel business, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Daniel Clough joins us from Youth Radio in Oakland. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Neil.
And the first thing I think most readers will notice is that the story is told in a series of one-page chapters with titles like Agent of Change, Nightcap, Bad News, Post Office. Why'd you decide to do it that way?
Well, one of my initial impetuses for the way the story was told was I was reading the collected Peanuts editions that Fantagraphics has been putting out, and in which they have every strip from a given, you know, year or two. And to read them in sequence, it felt like a new way to tell a story in a way. I mean, that wasn't Charles Schulz's goal, was for you to read them all at once, that you were supposed to read them every day. But to read them in sequence, it really felt like it was replicating the way that you remember the passage of time in memory. You know, you remember just the sort of high moments, emotional highs and lows, or certain resonating moments of a given year, and you may have five of those in one day and not another one for 2 months. And that was what I wanted the structure of the story to feel like. That I wanted it to feel like these days passing by, and with every day we sort of have a different view of ourselves. And so each strip is drawn in a different style to kind of capture that.
I think, like a lot of people, start with the comics first thing every morning. And in a way, this book is a little like a return to that, as you suggest, but a little more calculated. For example, I mentioned a chapter called Post Office, where Wilson is mailing off a package, which plays a interesting role later in the book.
Right. That's that was sort of the fun of working on this strip. I hadn't thought of the payoff of that strip as I was drawing the first one. I just found that kind of a funny punchline, which, of course, the poor audience out there will have to find out for themselves.
Yeah, find out for themselves. But it does play, it comes back, I think, a couple of times.
Yes. It became sort of a leitmotif in the story.
There is also a change in style in some of the chapters. Each of the chapters is pretty consistent, but in some of the chapters it's very realistic, sort of graphic novel cartooning. In some of them he's drawn very Sunday funny style.
Yeah, you know, when I first started to work on this, I was trying to come up with a overall style that would work for all of the strips, and I found I was veering wildly in my experimenting to see what that style would be. I was going from, you know, crazy kind of 50s cartoon wackiness to what approaches realism in comics with shading and correct lighting and things like that. And I really couldn't decide. I felt like some of them worked for some strips and some worked for others. And at a certain point, I realized that In some way, my brain had figured out the proper style for the book, which was to do all of these things at once and to kind of modulate each story with this style, to turn something that could just play as a kind of a stupid joke into something that reads more like, you know, a tragic punchline rather than a comic punchline.
Yeah, the graphic, the panels give you the advantage of timing. You don't think of it that way, but you do. You can have the pause and then the punchline.
That's kind of the art of doing these kind of comics in particular is the pacing, and that's what all the time is spent on. You know, there's a strip in the book where Wilson's talking to his daughter that he's just reconnected with, and she's crying throughout the strip, and it, you know, the way you show crying in a comic is to have someone say sob. And so I spent literally a week figuring out every permutation of you know, which panels does she say sob, and if it was in every panel, it seemed sort of monotonous, and it seemed sort of artificial, and if it was missing in some panels, it didn't seem quite right. And so it's the little things like that that make comics come to life.
Unless it's Superman, and then it's Choke.
Choke, yes. I use Choke, too. I like Choke.
Choke is good, yes. Yeah. There are some panels in which Wilson's nose grows rather dramatically, and I could not discern that he was lying any more than he was in any of the other strips.
You're reading more into it than I intended, Neil.
Okay. All right. So no Pinocchio analogy.
No
here.
Pinocchio references, please.
I wanted to ask you, this was the first, we're told, all of your other books, and you've written graphic novels before, but they were all serialized previously, and this is the first one presented as a whole.
Yes.
And even so, presenting something as a whole, you do it episodically.
Yes. Well, that's... I don't know. It felt like a book to me. It felt, as I was saying, it came out of the sort of uber text of Peanuts, and,
mm-hmm.
and so it felt like a collection of a comic strip, and that would be in book form. I really wanted Wilson to be. I started out with the idea of him as a cartoon character, and I wanted it to almost feel like some forgotten, third tier cartoon character that ran in the, Cleveland Plain Dealer in 1975, somebody you just vaguely remember. And that's why I gave him such a generic name, Wilson. It's just such a comic strip kind of name.
We all know him, and we don't necessarily want him to sit at our table at the coffee shop.
No, I find I have mixed emotions about Wilson. He's sort of my eternal nemesis. I'm the kind of guy who's sitting at the coffee shop and the Wilsons of the world will look around and sit at my table and say, it's been 10 years since I kicked my cocaine habit, or, start a loaded conversation like that. I have the kind of face that looks like I'm going to, be a good listener. And so on the one hand, I feel victimized by the Wilsons of the world, but on the other hand, I actually admire them. I always, when that guy finally leaves my table, I always think, boy, I kind of wish I could do that. I feel like I'm very overly concerned with, how I appear to others and not bothering anybody. And I kind of like the idea of someone who feels this sort of connection with others that he can just comfortably sit down, even though it ultimately causes him to have less connection with others.
So you don't sit down and blurt out that you were nominated for an Academy Award?
Well, yeah, no, I do that all the time.
Let's get some callers
yeah,
in the conversation.
Please.
Daniel Klaus is with us from Oakland. Let's start with John. John with us from Vineland in New Jersey.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
My question is about your use of color, Mr. Klaus, and tone, like hues. You use a lot, like in Ghost World and David Boring. I'm curious as to why you do that instead of using broader colors. A lot of times, where you do in Wilson.
With Ghost World, it was a matter of economics at the time. I would have loved to have done a full color comic back then, but comics were such a that was kind of before the big graphic novel boom, and I was, doing them in just those little comic pamphlets that we all grew up with, and very few people were buying those things, and it was a miracle I could even get the added color blue that we used in Ghost World, so it's often just a decision based on things like that. I did a book called David Boring that's mostly in black and white, but all of a sudden there are parts of it that appear in color, and I wanted to do that to show that it was a conscious choice to make it in black and white, that I did have the option of making the whole thing in color, but that I was opting intentionally for black and white. And I was really trying to sort of replicate the look of an old black and white movie, like, the feeling of being a kid and waking up in the middle of the night and going to, watch on your black and white TV and catching some weird old movie that you don't understand. Of course, that's an experience no kid today would ever have, but...
Also, if there's enough time for another question, I'd like to know what your feelings of the term graphic novel are, opposed to comics.
I was adamantly opposed to it when that was first proposed 15 or so years ago. I mean, it's a terrible term, because most of the stuff that is called a graphic novel is not at all a novel. You know, Art Spiegelman's Mouse is not a novel. Alison Bechdel's Fun Home is not a novel, and yet those are called graphic novels. And it's kind of an insulting term to comics. You know, comics should kind of have its own word. But
yeah, it was thought of as a marketing term. So.
It's a marketing term, and you know, I have to say, I've given up, and I now realize that it's taken on its own meaning, and I can talk to one of my neighbors, and they'll say, "Oh, you do graphic novels," and they'll know about the term. And you know, it's you think about, you know, the term movies is a really stupid term, and nobody really questions that anymore. And I feel like graphic novel is kind of headed in that direction, where we don't even think of the words. It has its own new meaning, and I'm willing to give up and accept that.
Collecting every six issue story arc of Green Lantern is now a graphic novel. So
exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Sort of trade paperbacks, as I grew up to call them.
John, thanks very much for the call.
All right, thank you for having me.
We're talking with Daniel Clowes. His new book is Wilson. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Mark, and Mark with us from Cleveland.
Hello, Mr. Clowes. Wilson will probably be a better choice for a plain dealer than some of the comics they're running now.
They might have a problem with some of the language, but other than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I haven't read Wilson yet, but I wanted to ask you about your earlier book about Dan Pussy, the sort of pathetic cartoonist, and it followed him through his life. What prompted you to write that book, and do you think anything will have changed for that character, in the years since you wrote it?
Well, you know, that book came out of, I began doing what would be classified, I suppose, as underground comics in the tradition of Robert Crumb and that crowd. In the late 80s, I started doing my own comic called 8-Ball, and it had nothing to do with superheroes or with any of the kind of common tropes that were very overwhelmingly present in comics at that time. And so I'd find myself going to comic conventions or comic shops, and my comics would always be in like a cardboard box in the back of the comic shop that would say, you know, like adult pornography or something. You know, and we were always ghettoized in such a way that I started to get really angry at the whole the acceptance that, well, superhero comics are obviously the correct form of comics, and all this other stuff is just, you know, kind of an annoying sideline to the industry. And so I would I did those comics about a comic artist named Dan Pussy, who was a consummate superhero comics professional, and it was based on all the stories I had heard about comics professionals being treated horribly over the history of comics, just being exploited by publishers, and it was sort of a fun way to get my anger out about it. But I sort of quickly lost interest in that whole side of the business, and I realized that it's now taken over the entire media. You know, that superhero movies are the biggest movies, and it's again, I give up. I'm not fighting that fight anymore, and I'm happy to just not really pay much attention to it.
Besides, a couple of your works have become movies as well.
There you go.
And they even gave them capes.
That's right.
Mark, thanks very much.
Have a good one.
The economics of the business have changed enough that you didn't have to publish these in black and white pamphlets that would end up in a cardboard box in the back of the comic book store?
Well, I mean, it's actually to the extent that people are actively discouraging you from doing those pamphlets. You know, nobody wants to sell some floppy thing that they, you know, that gets all bent on the shelf. You know, no bookstore wants to carry it because the profit margin is so low. You know, everybody hates them. So I just felt like, why continue with this? It seems like, you know, you always hear the story of it. You know, if you took an ant and blew it up to the size of a dog, it would collapse under its own weight. And it's almost like that's what's happened with a pamphlet comic book. You know, it's gotten so expensive and it doesn't work the way it used to. It used to be this disposable throwaway thing that you bought for, you know, 10 or 25 cents and you didn't worry about it. And now it's, you know, I don't even know what they cost, $5.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it just I think books make more sense at this point.
I've read the comic about that giant ant, and he's got super strength, actually. So physics be damned, and biology.
He can fly,
exactly. We've gotten a lot of calls of people theorizing about the inspiration for Wilson. Was it Charlie Brown?
Well, not you know, I wouldn't say Wilson is Charlie Brown, but Charlie Brown does have a certain you know, Wilson is very egocentric and kind of sees the world through his own filter, and I feel like Charlie Brown is a particularly egocentric character. You know, he's always you sort of look at Charlie Brown objectively, and he seems to have plenty of friends, and you know, he seems to have a fairly happy, normal life, and yet he's forever, you know, awash in misery over little slights and feeling abused by the world. And I think Wilson has a bit of that.
Daniel Close, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Neil. It's a pleasure.
Daniel Klaus is an Academy Award-nominated American author, screenwriter, and cartoonist of alternative comic books. He writes comics. He joined us from Youth Radio Studios in Oakland, California, where he lives. His new book is called Wilson. You can see several panels from Wilson in an excerpt at our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Tomorrow, it's our weekly visit from the Political Junkie. Ken Rudin will be here, a special Rocky Mountain edition of Political Junkie. Join us then. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.